from deep inside your radio.
Ladies and gentlemen, concrete flood walls. Now, first of all, this is a bete noire of mine. So many people on network and cable news are referring to what rebreached, in New Orleans, Louisiana this past week as levees. Now, I know that they like to say that because it makes them sound like, hey, we're hip with that Southern thing. But if I'm not mistaken, and I don't think I am, otherwise I wouldn't be here. They don't allow mistaken people on public radio, ladies and gentlemen. Those weren't the levees that breached. The levees are earthen berms. You know, I'd like to say that, see. I'd like to say that more than levees. Berms. And they held up, even though they were only designed for a Category 3 hurricane, which, by the way, is all either Rita or Katrina were, I think, at landfall. Check me on that. I know I'm on public radio. I can't be wrong, but check me on that. But anyway, what breached twice in New Orleans at the 17th Street Canal, the Industrial Canal, and the London Street Canal were flood walls, not made of earth. It comes up because of this from New Scientist magazine. Concrete flood walls that were supposed to protect New Orleans were not overwhelmed by high waters during Hurricane Katrina, as federal officials, specifically those of the Army Corps of Engineers, which built the darn things, have claimed. Says New Scientist, they ruptured because they were structurally flawed. And they are quoting Louisiana scientists. I know it sounds like an oxymoron, but it's not. From the mud splattered on buildings still standing near to the flood walls and the results of a computer simulation of the storm, known as a hindcast, don't get excited. It's not what you think. It's just the opposite of a forecast. A team from the Hurricane Center at Louisiana State University claims it is pieced together how the walls mounted on small earthen levees, mounted on top of small earthen levees, ladies and gentlemen, must have broken. Says Paul Kemp, an oceanographer at the Hurricane Center, quote, either there was a design problem or a construction problem, unquote. No, he requotes himself here. They were not supposed to break, unquote. What is it that's supposed to break? Can we have a list of those? Because those would be the ones I wouldn't buy or advise the government not to buy. The supposed to break list. Man, that would talk about pulling down the server. Can you imagine if you had a website with the supposed to break list? Phew. Drudge thinks he gets hits. The U.S. Army Corps of Engineers, back to the article, the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers responsible for building and maintaining the levees still claims that the flood walls were simply overtopped by the storm surge. But according to the LSU Hurricane Center, which, you know, what do they know? They just are sitting there with their hindcasts. I told you, don't get excited. And one more appealing story on the subject of Katrina. This from earlier this week. The trucks started arriving last weekend. They're expected to keep coming through today. That is today, really today. Today as we speak. City officials say they have no idea why the trucks arrived. This is a city in Maine. The city has been asked to help out with traffic problems, but the truck drivers that a television station spoke to said they went all the way down to the Gulf Coast with their load of ice, stayed for a few days, and then were told by FEMA they needed to drive to Maine to store it. The truck drivers from all over the country say they were subcontracted by FEMA. They started arriving last weekend. As many as 200 trucks could come to this city in Maine. What city? It doesn't say. City in Maine by this weekend. 200 trucks. Told by FEMA, go to Maine. Don't go to the Gulf Coast. Because who there needs ice? The trucks are storing the ice at Americold, a company with a warehouse. Oh, it's Portland, Maine. Sorry. Trucks can only... no one knows if the... or even if the ice will ever go back to the Gulf Coast. But I'll tell you who is going back to the Gulf Coast now in the wake of the bewildering performance after Katrina. President Bush back in Louisiana today for his fifth visit. And he says, I believe this is an accurate quote, that he will keep coming back to New Orleans and Louisiana until he finds those weapons of mass destruction. Hello, welcome to the show.
Straight to ground. Can't you see me overtaking all the down on Mutton Street, the moon is peeping through. Oh, what's a young man, you better watch your P's and Q's. Life is good on Mutton Street if you know the why and where. Robbing on the bomb sites, there's magic everywhere. We're the boys of Mutton Street, Mutton Street, Mutton Street. We're the boys of Mutton Street, we give no ground. We're the boys of Mutton Street, Mutton Street, Mutton Street. We're the boys of Mutton Street, we give no ground. We came upon those burly boys that were shaking like a leaf. We had our stones and dusters and we were armed right to the teeth. We fought a friendly volley and we only maimed a few. And quick as greasy lightning, they disappeared from view. We're the boys of Mutton Street, Mutton Street, Mutton Street. We're the boys of Mutton Street, we give no ground. We're the boys of Mutton Street, Mutton Street, Mutton Street. We're the boys of Mutton Street, we give no ground. The bonfire night, it was a sight, the bonfire how it blazed. Nearly set the streets alight, so they called the fire brigade. The fire brigade got busy, but we cut the hoses clean. And suddenly the mutton boys were nowhere to be seen. We're the boys of Mutton Street, Mutton Street, Mutton Street. We're the boys of Mutton Street, we give no ground. We're the boys of Mutton Street, Mutton Street, Mutton Street. We're the boys of Mutton Street, we give no ground. Hockey on the corner, shell shock fusilier. Tip him a little drink, you'll get your cigarettes and beer. Thomas Taplin Sr. got soda poppin' news. Scott and Sons got toys for boys, but they push their Christian views. We're the boys of Mutton Street, Mutton Street, Mutton Street. We're the boys of Mutton Street, we give no ground. We're the boys of Mutton Street, Mutton Street, Mutton Street. We're the boys of Mutton Street, we give no ground.
From the edge of America, from the home of the homeless, I'm Harry Shearer, welcoming you to this edition of Le Show. And now, before we do anything else, it's time for me to read the trades for you. Not really from a trade this week, but trade-worthy, because it's an inside glimpse at a new marketing move. Subliminal messages from cigarette companies. I'll read it for you. This is from the London Sunday Observer, actually. Internal marketing plans drawn up by Philip Morris last year and obtained by the Observer show that the tobacco company is offering financial incentives to bar managers to fill their facilities with furniture bearing the Marlboro logo, or place its branded ashtrays and vending machines in areas where smoking is allowed. This is in the anticipation of a total ban on cigarette advertising in Britain. The company also experimented with subliminal ways of communicating its brand through themed bar areas, which could be put up at major social events, and did not feature the Marlboro logo or its packaging. These installations, as they were called, created lounge areas by placing comfortable red sofas in front of video screens showing scenes redolent of Wild West Marlboro country to convey the essence of the cigarette brand while circumnavigating sponsorship brands. One plan Philip Morris experimented with was the use of chill-out smoking areas. These featured a sofa shaped like a bath to give the impression it was an area in which smokers could relax. Philip Morris would pay for the installation known as the Marlboro Motel to be erected. That way the company could say they were paying for the right to sell cigarettes rather than sponsoring an event. That's according to one person familiar with the installations. All that former advertising money has to go somewhere, said one industry insider. The tobacco firms are looking to create extensive design languages in bars and clubs and other venues through the use of particular types of furniture or material which will make people think of their brands. Experts said such marketing was becoming increasingly popular. Quote, the more subtle the message, the more likely it is to be accepted, says Gerald Hastings, director of the Institute for Social Marketing at Sterling University. Who knew there was a Sterling University? If you see something blatant, it forewarns you, he says, but if it's something subliminal, it will go under the radar. Well, that's a tautology, isn't it, Gerald? The elite teams of marketing experts were armed with scripts to use when approaching bar managers. Quote, "Our customers are your customers," runs the script. Nearly 80% of Marlboro smokers are aged 18 to 35. The teams were told to stress Marlboro's arguably the world's best-known brand after Coca-Cola. The company also sought to secure exclusive retail rights at the Glastonbury Music Festival in England and a number of other high-profile music events where attractive female Marlboro models, not to be confused with Marlboro motels, would sell cigarettes. A spokesman for Philip Morris of the company did not discuss its marketing plans. Not unrelated, but not related. Seeking to draw a younger audience, KSBY in San Luis Obispo, California, their news department is giving the cast of a VH1 reality series, The Surreal Life, airtime on the station's newscast this week. What? I'm reading it for you, too. The series cast this upcoming season includes Sherman Hemsley, Steve Harwell, lead singer of Smash Mouth, Cece DeVille from the rock band Poison, actress Tawny Catane, yes, I said actress, Alexis Arquette, sister of actors Patricia, Rosanna, and David, and Florence Henderson, the former Brady Bunch mom, serving as the in-house therapist for the cast members. But wait, I'm not through. The celebrities will experience what it's like to present a live portion of KSBY's evening newscast from 6:40 to 7 p.m. Tim Perry, the station's president and general manager, said KSBY is trying to attack the 18 to 34-year-old demographic, which is its most challenging portion. Well, they're off smoking cigarettes. What do you want? Can't be watching the news while you're smoking cigarettes. The news is disturbing, and the cigarettes are so relaxing. Some of the cast will go live to cover the farmer's market. Others will be in the studio presenting weather and sports, according to Dan Dennison, KSBY News Director. But they're not going to be doing hard news, Dennison said. We've made it very clear, but we're maintaining the credibility of our newscast. Yeah, very clear. After the actors finish their newscast, they plan to dine at the Mission Grill. It's in the story. I don't know why that's there. And yet I do. How could it not be there? When I read the trades for you, a copyrighted feature of this broadcast, ladies and gentlemen, from our heck of a job file, another fine fella doing a heck of a job, all the way out the door, Food and Drug Administration Commissioner Lester Crawford announced his resignation this week, just 2 months after he was confirmed for the job. Heck of a job. His email notice to the FDA staff gave no reason for his surprise decision to step down. Sources familiar with his departure said he was asked to resign, though it's unclear why. Crawford has had a stormy tenure at the agency, not a stormy petrel, which has been beset by criticism from both the left and the right. Hey, they got to be doing something, right? He's doing a heck of a job. He's been criticized left and right. He's a hard worker. He's working hard. He was accused before his confirmation of having an improper relationship with a female colleague, a charge that both denied. The final report of the committee said there were significant discrepancies between Crawford's testimony and that of others in the commissioner's office. You see. Under Crawford's leadership, the agency has been accused of being lax in its safety requirements after the Vioxx scandal. The agency has also been buffeted by abortion politics over a proposal to make emergency contraception more easily available. This is the morning after pill controversy. So, Lester Crawford doing a heck of a job out the door, joining Mike Brown in that consultancy, I'm sure. And now, ladies and gentlemen, news from outside the bubble. Because understandably this week, we haven't been distracted by a missing white teenager. We've been distracted by Katrina and Rita. So maybe this legitimately has gone by the boards, but here it comes. Saudi Arabia warned this week that the situation in Iraq is moving toward disintegration. This is from Saudi Arabia, ladies and gentlemen. A growing danger the country will dissolve into a civil war. There are those words again. Who said that first? Wasn't it the CIA 2 years ago, 3 years ago? A civil war that will draw its neighbors into a broader regional conflict. Saudi Foreign Minister Saud Faisal, visiting Washington, told reporters his government has also warned the Bush administration of the dangers of Iraq's unraveling because of tensions between rival ethnic and religious groups. Weren't those the ethnic tensions that Paul Wolfowitz said there was no history of in Iraq? Yes, ladies and gentlemen, those were. Faisal, the Saudi foreign minister, said the ethnic tensions were never as bad during former President Saddam Hussein's rule as they are today. Hey, freedom's messy. The impression, this is a quote, the impression is gradually going toward disintegration. There seems to be no dynamic now that is pulling the country together. All the dynamics there are pushing the Iraqi people away from each other. As a result, Iraq is now a very threatening challenge, undermining stability throughout the Middle East. Yeah, we were going to remake the Middle East, all right. We did. Mission accomplished. Quote, it will draw the countries of the region into conflict. That is the main worry of all the neighbors of Iraq, he said. Faisal also warned the Iraq's further disintegration would bring Shiite-dominated Iran more directly into support for Iraq's Shiite majority, while Turkey would not allow a Kurdish country to emerge on its border. This just in. Yeah. This would explain why Iraq's neighbors haven't even sent ambassadors. Story we had, what, last week? Yeah. Diplomats in the British Foreign Office are working frantically in private on what they refer to as the exit ticket from Iraq, according to the London newspaper The Guardian. In contrast to the official line that the British forces will remain until the job is done. Hey, the job's done. What's your problem? The Foreign Office wants to engineer a set of circumstances in which both Britain and the U.S. can begin to reduce troops next year. Ambitions for Iraq are being drastically scaled down in private. Foreign Office source said the goal of the U.S. administration to turn Iraq into a beacon of democracy in the Middle East had long ago been shelved. Quote, we will settle for leaving behind an Iraq democracy that is creaking along, unquote, the source said. From May 2003 until this spring, the line at the Foreign Office briefings to journalists in London and Baghdad was that security was improving. The tone and content are now a darker reflection of what is happening. These days, there is little or no optimism in the briefings from the British Foreign Office. The source said the priority for withdrawal was merely that, quote, George Bush is not seen to have failed. The second priority is also an American one. The U.S. does not want a legacy of Iran having extended its influence over the Middle East, unquote, the source said. Lots of luck, department. Hey, call Lester Crawford. He could help. And Mike Brown. They're doing heck of a jobless thing now. Meanwhile, The Guardian reports that senior military officers anxious about the security situation in Iraq are beginning to seriously question the role of British troops in the country. Colonel Tim Collins, commander of the 1st Rebellion of the Royal Irish Regiment during the invasion, attacked the handling of the invasion and subsequent operations. We have clearly no plan, he said. We are relying entirely on military muscle to impose freedom and democracy. He said British commanders had no idea about the complexities of Iraq at the time of invasion. The gravest mistake, he said, is that we took away the Iraqi police, the army, and took away the intelligence services. That left a dangerous vacuum, Colonel Collins said. Jeff Hoon, British Defense Secretary at the time of the invasion, this week admitted the British government had failed to prepare for the extent of the insurgency. He told the Parliamentary House magazine, quote, I recognize we did not anticipate the full extent of the fanaticism, the violence, and the terror used by those who oppose a free Iraq, unquote. The U.S. and Iraqi governments have overstated the number of foreign fighters in Iraq, feeding the myth that they're the backbone of the insurgency. The Center for Strategic and International Studies, an American think tank based in Washington, also reports that foreign militants account for fewer than 10% of the estimated 30,000 insurgents. More I think there's a little more. $1 billion has been plundered from Iraq's defense ministry in one of the largest thefts in history, according to the British newspaper The Independent, leaving the country's army to fight the insurgency with museum piece weapons. The money intended to train and equip an Iraqi army was instead siphoned abroad in cash and has disappeared. It is possibly one of the largest thefts in history, according to Ali Alawi, Iraq's finance minister. Huge amounts of money have disappeared. In return, we got nothing but scraps of metal. Unquote. The carefully planned theft has so weakened the army it cannot hold Baghdad against insurgent attack without American support, Iraqi officials say, making it difficult for the U.S. to withdraw. Most of the money was supposedly spent buying arms from Poland and Pakistan. The contracts were peculiar. They were awarded without bidding. What's peculiar about that? It's the way we do things. They were signed with a Baghdad-based company, not directly with the foreign supplier. The money was paid up front, and surprisingly for Iraq, it was paid at great speed out of the ministry's account with the central bank. Senior Iraqi officials now say they cannot understand how, if this is so, the disappearance of almost all the military procurement budget could have passed unnoticed by the U.S. military in Baghdad and civilian advisors working in the defense ministry. Ladies and gentlemen, news from outside the bubble. Maybe the bubble's better. It's like having a cigarette to be in the bubble.
Desprezou seu amor, agora é tarde demais. Não sofro mais essa dor. Sorriu para mim, não disse nada, porém fez um jeitinho de quem quer voltar. Dançava com alguém que desprezou seu amor. Agora é tarde demais, não sofro mais essa dor. Desprezou seu amor, agora é tarde demais. Não sofro mais essa dor. Sorriu para mim, não disse nada, porém fez um jeitinho de quem quer voltar. Dançava com alguém que desprezou seu amor, agora é tarde demais. Não sofro mais essa dor. Dum 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 d
This is Le Show, and we bring you now news from Minnesota, ladies and gentlemen. Yeah, something we do every once in a great while. A local blogger has agreed to stop marketing and selling his parody T-shirts that say on the front of them, "A Prairie Ho Companion," after Garrison Keillor's lawyers went after him with a cease and desist order. Rex Sorgatz, creator of the MNSpeak.com website, says the T-shirts are only temporarily out of commission until he decides the next step. "I don't know what I'm going to do," he said. "I've got plenty of lawyers that want to talk to me." Keillor's attorney, Eric Nielsen, said the cease and desist order is meant to protect the name of Keillor's A Prairie Home Companion public radio show and upcoming movie by the same name. Quote, "He's got a copyright interest in this name and he just wants to protect it. Nothing personal," Nielsen said. The T-shirts were released this summer while the movie was being filmed in St. Paul. On his website, Sorgatz defends the T-shirts, saying that they're similar to others he's sold on the site, such as "Lake Street is for Lovers," another parody T-shirt apparently, nothing more. Quote, "I found it disappointing that it would even reach this stage," he said. And now it's reached another stage.
"Well, sir, it's just been a quiet week in Lake Reverie, Minnesota, my hometown. Just on the edge of the prairie. Miss Katrina Nyquist down at the Catbox Cafe, she's still getting ribbed a lot by the customers about her first name, don't you know? Father Svenlin of the Improved Lutheran Church, he walked in on, I think it was a Tuesday morning, before even ordering his New Slant sausage, he calls out to her in the back of the kitchen area there. 'I heard Hurricane Katrina blew through here.' After about a week of that, Miss Katrina had almost had enough. But Father Sven was such a generous tipper in a town not noted for its adherence to big city tipping etiquette, that she swallowed her baser impulses, including the one to point out to Father Sven that it was easy to be a big tipper when you were doing it out of the collection box. Down at the Fuss and Budget store, Ole Ingebretson was grumbling about having to take the T-shirts with the amusing slogans off the shelves. All of a sudden, of course, it was Ole's habit to grumble about just about anything that involved the actual making of a physical effort, as opposed to the work he did most of the time, which was thumbing through the catalogs of the big city stores and making a list for his boss, 75-year-old Fred Nyswang, of what merchandise to order for the next season. But the amusing T-shirt removal project was especially painful to Ole, because he knew what consistent sellers those shirts were. And he knew that that was good for everybody in what Mr. Nyswang called the Fuss and Budget family. The most popular T-shirt, of course, was still the blue one with the white lettering that said, "Kiss me, I'm Norwegian." The second most popular was the white one with the blue lettering that said the same thing. But coming up fast and looking especially promising for the Christmas season, don't you know, was this T-shirt that Ole himself was wearing at that moment. The one with the very lifelike illustration of a book cover. Not one of those great books covers with the gold lettering on the dark red binding, or the trashy airport paperback books with the embossed titles and in the words big enough that even the target audience of the books could read them. No, this was a cover that looked like a book of homey wisdom printed in the late 19th or early 20th century. And in sort of antique-y style lettering, you could see the title of the book right in the center of the shirt. It said, "A Prairie Hokum Compendium." And it was that very shirt that was causing Ole to spend his lunch hour dreaming of the Friday special sandwich at the Catbox Cafe, the double-deckered lutefisk salad on white, when what he was actually doing was taking all the "Kiss Me, I'm Norwegians" and "Prairie Hokum Compendiums," all the My father took me to Lake Reverie and I didn't even get this lousy t-shirt. And fold them up real nice and neatly. And fill up a big cardboard carton with them and then seal up the carton with that shipping tape that sounds, well, it's coming off the reel like you're pulling up about 10 feet of old linoleum with a claw hammer. Worst of it was, far as Ole understood it, was this out-of-town fellow from down in one of the twin cities, don't you know, who was causing all the uproar. Of course, in a town as small as Lake Reverie, one store clerk, unhappy about having to spend his lunch hour boxing up the t-shirt inventory, was about the closest thing they'd had to a real certified uproar since Gustafson's Hardware had lost its true value affiliation over a billing dispute. Old man Gustafson had decided that John Madden was too overweight to be a proper hardware spokesperson on television and was depositing his checks for true value into an escrow account down at the Farmers and Seamen's Bank until the folks at True Value headquarters saw the error of their ways. Anyway, the big city fella, Galen Clemesrud, was to Ole's way of thinking rich enough that, well, sir, he could buy the Fuss and Budget store, the Gustafson's Hardware, and the Catbox Cafe combined with just the change he had on him. Mr. Clemesrud, only thought of him as Mr. Clemesrud because your sons and daughters of bachelor Norwegian fishermen are so very polite even about those they look down on, like Swedes. But Mr. Clemesrud had a public radio program, sometimes he even had a public television program, and only figured if there was such a thing as a subscriber-supported movie where they had a pledge drive between the fourth and fifth reels of the picture, Mr. Clemesrud would have one of those, too. He'd made a real comfortable living telling stories about his fictional hometown, a place a lot like Lake Reverie, but with a few more Catholics. And now some kid from town, specifically Caleb Yorn, set up a website. Caleb was Grant and Betty Yorn's oldest boy. He'd taken first prize at the Wauwatonka County Science Fair 4 years in a row each year with the same exhibit, a self-cleaning lawnmower. Caleb may well have been the cleverest teenager Lake Reverie had seen since Katrina's younger brother Joel had gone off to the Twin Cities with the proceeds of the first annual and only Lake City's ice fishing rodeo. He'd actually brought in cowboys from the Dakotas to wrestle calves on ice, but it just happened to be a late frost that year, and the town smelled of wet cows until well after Groundhog Day. So Caleb, don't you know, is so computer savvy, he can find the scandals before they even get into the Drudge Report. His first big splash on the town's media scene came in 2003 when he got access to that year's Farmer's Almanac 2 weeks before it came out, stored it on his computer, went down to Nicky's Printing and Things, printed up about 200 copies of it, and sold his bootleg Farmer's Almanacs for half price at a little table in front of the Haddockoff Pharmacy. Mr. Haddockoff was a German Lutheran from the old school, and he didn't much like the idea of cheating the farmers who made the almanac every year. But then Caleb showed him an article from Parade magazine that said the almanac had been owned for the last 10 years by an Italian media baron. So Mr. Haddockoff had let Caleb come right inside the store and set up his table opposite the cash register, where he sold the gums and the mints and the AA batteries and year-old lottery tickets. Now, Caleb had discovered the internet, and even though he was still stuck, thanks to the old-fashioned ways of his folks with the cranky dial-up connection, he'd managed to set up a kind of smart-alecky website that made fun of public radio celebrities. And he updated it every day. But the t-shirt was Caleb's first commercial venture with the website, and he'd just gotten a second order from the Fuss and Budget store. For second order 15, when the letter came. 15 t-shirts. That's double the original order. And Caleb just just begun thinking about very dangerous thoughts, you know, about how I might even trade in his used Neon for a new entry-level Hyundai, and about how he would start asking out some of the girls from St. Olaf's College. Dangerous, dangerous thoughts. And then Charlie Varnquist, at the mailman with the trick knee, stumbled up the porch to the Yorn mailbox, and while he steadied himself with his left hand on the Yorn's milk jug crate, he slipped a brilliant white envelope with the return address in fancy embossed black letters into the mail slot. Caleb had opened the envelope before Charlie had managed to stumble back down the stairs and back onto his Postal Service golf cart. And even a clever teenager like Caleb could only make out a couple of the words in the two-page letter from the Minneapolis law firm of Strode and Strode. The words were cease and desist. Mr. Galen Clemmersrud was asking Caleb, well, actually through one of the Strode boys, he was telling Caleb to cease and desist the selling of the T-shirt with the picture of the book cover that said Prairie Hokum Compendium on it. Caleb read the letter a couple of times. He thought it might be a hoax from one of his website's regular readers, clever teenage boys from all over Minnesota. But the more he looked at the brilliant white paper it was printed on and the embossed black letterhead and the decisive sweep of the signature of Lowell Strode III, the more Caleb realized that he was in what his mother Betty liked to call a giant tub full of hot water. Now, since he was a sophisticated young man of the modern age, Caleb's first reaction was to go upstairs to his room, turn on his laptop computer, compose a 4-page essay for his website. It wasn't so much composed as it was extruded under extreme pressure. Even by the fiery standards of the internet, Caleb's essay was a sizzler. He called Mr. Clemmersrud a liver-spotted windbag. He pasted in a scan of the letter from Mr. Strode III with ha-has written all over it. And he described the whole idea of the letter as a container of a warm substance that was definitely not a big tub full of hot water. And that was, as Katrina told him over a cup of instant hot imitation cocoa down at the Catbox Cafe the next afternoon, that was his second mistake. Listen, kiddo, she told him in her 8-cigarette-a-day voice. If you're going to go up against the big guys, get yourself a big guy. Otherwise, they're going to be picking little slices of you out of their tire treads before nightfall. Oldie came by too and said he was already planning to stop giving his usual annual donation to public radios as his form of protest. And the fact that it would serve as a safety net in case heating oil was more expensive this winter wasn't a bad thing either, but Caleb really should take the cancellation of the donation as a protest. Father Heckland saw Caleb that evening at the regular Thursday church social and took the young man aside, put a pastorly arm around his shoulder, and told him that maybe God had chosen this moment to bring Caleb a valuable lesson about the limits of disrespect on the internet. Later that night, about 11 o'clock, when Grant and Betty Yorn were asleep, naturally, Betty was up reading a gossip magazine while Grant was asleep snoring that snore that sounds like a chainsaw working its way through a block of concrete, Caleb sat at his computer reading little messages of advice from all the clever young teenagers around the state who had become his fans. All of them were telling him in one way or another, don't give up, don't give in to the letter, don't cease, don't desist. Don't sell out to the liver-spotted windbag in the big city. That's the message that was coming from all these peers that Caleb had never met, who probably lived in big towns or cities, and who probably had even seen Galen Clemesrud in person, who'd have been dragged to see him by their folks. And now they wanted their revenge. All that night, as the town lay under its mantle of the first real frost of the season, Caleb, he lay in his bed, thinking about what a young man is supposed to do. Is he supposed to be brave and reckless and true to even his most trivial opinions? Or is he supposed to adhere to the rules laid down by the expensive lawyers with the embossed letterhead, be a responsible adult, and cease and desist? Well, so when Caleb got up the next day, he found out that his decision had been made for him. Fred Nyswang, the 75-year-old owner of the Fuss and Budget store, had heard about the letter from Ole. And Fred was one of those people that you really need in a small town who believe that nothing, absolutely nothing, is worth a ruckus. So first thing that morning, Fred had gone down to Nikki's printing and things and had dictated a letter to Nikki Sarnstad and had her send it to Mr. Galen Clemesrud. It was, I guess you could say, it was a letter of spineless submission. On behalf of Caleb Yorn, Mr. Nyswang promised not only to destroy all the offending T-shirts in his inventory, but to make Caleb destroy whatever it was that allowed him to make the shirts so that no more could ever be created. And on behalf of the Yorn family, Mr. Nyswang also pledged to become a platinum supporter of public radio. And could he please have the Car Talk CD as his premium? Well, Caleb rode the county bus to the community college in a daze. Had Fred Nyswang done him the biggest favor of his young life? Or had he somehow stolen from Caleb one of the foundation stones for the manhood he was trying to construct? Caleb got the answer a few days later. Right about the time the Apple Festival was ending and folks began putting up the decorations for the Pumpkin Festival, Charlie Varnquist wobbled onto the porch that Saturday and left a package on the swing, rang the bell, and wavered unsteadily to back down the stairs. Caleb didn't so much race to get whatever Charlie had left in the way a teenage boy in Lake Reverie can still be excited about getting mail, but he nearly careened into Betty Yorn's pumpkin castle, sitting by the front door, waiting to be taken down to the school auditorium for the pumpkin sculpting contest. Caleb ripped open the package, and inside there was something wrapped in tissue paper and nestled on a pillow of styrofoam popcorn. Betty called from the kitchen to ask what the package was, and Caleb told her it was nothing. Then he tore off the tissue paper and took a look at what was inside. It was an official Galen Clemesrud T-shirt and a New Yorkerish cartoon of Galen with a very big head, a speech balloon coming out of his head saying, "Public radio listeners do it with pledges." And before he set it down on the couch, Caleb noticed the little handwritten card taped to the bottom of the front of the shirt. It was signed by Galen Clemesrud, and it said, "Best wishes, and thanks for listening." That's the news from Lake Reverie, where all the folks are just like you and me, except only more like you than me. Well, thank you so much.
1, 2, 3. Crazy state I'm in. The crazy state I'm in.
I do whatever I can do, but it seems that when it comes to you, darling, enough is never quite enough.
Never quite enough.
We've all got secrets, everybody has their shame. Sometimes you fight them, but one thing's sure, they'll rise back up again.
Yes, they will.
They'll rise back up again. So you may use sex, pills or booze, whatever helps to soothe your blues, but you know, enough is never quite enough. It's never quite enough. People seem happy, so they make you think. We all need comfort, a nameless face, an early morning dream. An early morning dream. And if you wanted them, those memories, sit back, relax, and give in, please, but you know. Enough is never quite enough. Never quite enough. And if you want to dim those memories, sit back, relax, and give in, please. But you know, enough is never. Never quite enough.
Oh, oh, never quite enough.
Oh, no, 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 no.
Ladies and gentlemen, just another piece of news from outside the bubble for you. Afghan President Hamid Karzai, remember him? He had a meeting with international media in Kabul this week. Quote, the nature of the war on terror in Afghanistan has now changed to a point I don't think there's a big need for military activity anymore. Unquote. In an apparent reference to Pakistan's continued support of the Taliban. Hey, that's our ally Pakistan he's talking about. That's Pervez Musharraf there. Karzai also counseled the U.S. military that henceforth it should focus on cutting off the flow of militants by concentrating on where the terrorists are trained, on their bases, on the supply to them, on the money coming to them, unquote. Reacted to the recent Pakistani proposal for erecting a fence along the border between Afghanistan and Pakistan. Karzai rejected that proposal. He said it already, the existing line already divided tribes and families. It was separating people, not preventing terrorism. He was pointing the finger at Pakistan. Isn't it too early to point the finger, or is it too late? And finally, ladies and gentlemen, the Pentagon has no accurate knowledge of the cost of military operations in Iraq, Afghanistan, or the fight against terror. This is according to the Government Accountability Office. Hey, we had our accountability moment. No, no kidding. Neither the Defense Department or Congress can reliably know how much the war is costing or how appropriated funds are being spent, the report to Congress stated. The GAO says the problem is rooted in long-standing weaknesses in the Pentagon's outmoded financial management system, which is designed to handle small-scale contingencies. Wonder why. Ladies and gentlemen, that's going to conclude this week's edition of the show. The program returns next week at this same time over NPR worldwide throughout Europe on the USN 440 cable system in Japan, around the world through the facilities of the American Forces Network up and down the east coast of North America via the shortwave giant WBCQ 7.415 megahertz, the planet, around the world via the internet at two different locations, live and archived on your computer whenever you want it, harryshear.com and kcrw.com. Available as a free download at www.audible.com/theshow. Available on channel 108 at Sirius Satellite Radio. And available, this show is too available, and available as a podcast at kcrw.com. And it would be just like knowing how much the war's costing, if you'd agree to join with me then, would you? Would you really? All righty, thank you very much. Address for this broadcast is lemail, L-E-M-A-I-L, at interworld.net. LeShul Internet Services by Steve Mack. A tip of the LeShul chapeau to the San Diego and Pittsburgh desks. The show playlist available at harryshearer.com. The show comes to you from Century of Progress Productions and originates through the facilities of KCRW, Santa Monica, a community recognized around the world as the home of the homeless.